Jane and Michael Stern have traveled over 1,000,000 miles and gone through 17 cars searching for restaurants that still serve good regional home cooking. They've drawn a culinary portrait of America through their books Road Food, Good Food, Real American Food, and Square Meals. In their new book, A Taste of America, the Sterns have brought their readers along for the ride, sharing recipes from their favorite restaurants. When the Sterns hit the road, they look for restaurants whose character and menu bring their region to life. Over the years, the Sterns have had to develop a system for scouting good restaurants in unfamiliar places.
We have such a sophisticated system that if I tell you, it's going to sound like we're absolutely crazy, because it kind of relates to nothing except our own internal vibes, if I can use a 60s expression. For instance, Michael and I are always very leery of restaurants that have mansard roofs, you know, those sort of overhanging roofs. They usually have bad food. Why? I don't know. Also, restaurants with neon pigs or statues of pigs on the roof or in front of the door often have great food, as do restaurants with badly typed menus. For instance, there was a restaurant we saw that featured deep-fried eggplant, and their typewriter wasn't working, and so it came out as dupe-fried oop plant. And before we sat down and ordered the dupe-fried oop plant, we knew it was going to be great, and it was.
Well, that's a good system. So look for typos on the menu and pigs on the roof.
Dancing pigs, avoid mansard roofs, and when in doubt, follow the sheriff's car if you're in a small town, because the sheriff usually knows where the good breakfasts are.
I think that's a really good tip. Of course, that won't work in a big city, probably.
In a big city, what you've got to do is sniff. I mean, just open the door of the restaurant and take a whiff. We had lunch today at a restaurant that made great corned beef sandwiches. The minute we opened that door and just smelled the aroma of that curing corned beef, we knew we were in heaven.
I know you're lucky enough to have time to drive off the highway to find all these interesting restaurants. Sometimes when I'm on the road, I'm just in too much of a hurry and I end up eating on the highway. And I think things have gotten a lot worse as far
There's
as
no
the
question.
Highway food.
Well, if you have to eat next to the highway, there are occasionally some good restaurants right by the highway exits, but that is not where the good food is. The recipes that we gathered for A Taste of America come from way off the beaten path.
We have really never intended any of our books, from Road Food to A Taste of America or Real American Food or Good Food, to be companions for the busy interstate traveler. We really are more interested in giving a culinary portrait of this country, and unfortunately, that involves traveling far from the interstate. So I think the readers of our book are really more adventurers than they are busy travelers or businessmen looking for a quick meal.
But you think things have gotten worse on the road, though? Why do you think they've gotten worse?
Well, I'll tell you one reason they've gotten worse is because in the 1930s and 40s, truck drivers used to really frequent the wonderful little mom-and-pop cafes. Since trucks have gotten so big and really can't get off the interstates except, you know, in cities to unload, the mom-and-pop cafes by the side of the road have gone out of business and have been replaced by the big truck stops. And so those little travelers' cafes that were set up for truckers or for travelers are really a dying breed. And that's kind of one reason why we've been so passionate and so serious about finding this regional American food, is because it is disappearing in many cases. And even though every time we go out on the road and take a new trip, we do find a new regional specialty, from something as simple as American chop suey to turtle soup in southern Indiana, a lot of the little mom-and-pop highway cafes have gone out of business, and we really feel that it's our job to record them and to try and keep them in business if we can by writing about them.
What keeps you on the road traveling from restaurant to restaurant?
Hunger.
Yeah, it's funny because, you know, Michael and I are 41 years old now, and we started this when we were in our mid-20s, and I've always heard that one's appetite diminishes when you get older and one's ability to eat a lot of food diminishes. Well, it hasn't happened yet, I can happily say. So we still are eating, you know, 5 breakfasts before 9 a.m., and then we have 3 lunches and 4 dinners, and maybe my hips have spread a little bit in the 15 years, but it's... you know, it's still hunger, and we still really have the passion and energy to do it.
Your book, Square Meals, was a history, a recipe history, recipes from different eras that had all kinds of cultural insights to what life was like then. And the recipes ranged from tea room recipes to suburban recipes and to craft television theater, appetizer dip, things along those lines. Did you learn a lot about the kinds of foods you grew up on from having written that book? Did it put your childhood diet into perspective?
It really put almost much more than a childhood diet into perspective, because one of the things we found while doing Square Meals was our focus was really not even so much what people actually ate, but what they aspired to eat, what they thought they would be doing by setting oven-baked cornflake chicken on the table or tea room dainties on the table. That, to us, is what's so interesting about what you might call culinary anthropology, what it is that people are trying to say in the foods that they set before you. And I think that there lies what's really interesting about traveling around the country as well as traveling back through history about food, and that is seeing what it is that food means to people. It's a way of it's a way of socializing, a way of saying something about their heritage, about their neighborhood. And I think that is really far beyond just eating something. That's what's interesting about food.
Probably you've helped inspire a lot of regional restaurants around the country, but restaurants that prepare regional food that's not from the region the restaurant's in, if you know what I mean, like Mexican restaurants in Pennsylvania and New Orleans restaurants in New York.
Yeah, I know.
Do you ever try restaurants like that, that are regional food, but they're not in the region that the food is from?
We generally try to avoid them just because I have nothing against them, but they're just not that interesting to us. We really try to find food of its region. We wouldn't go to Paris and look for a hamburger, or we wouldn't go to Hamburg, Germany, and look for food from Brazil. Neither do we go to Chicago and look for New Orleans cuisine. On the other hand, you know, if you're not going to be traveling, Jane and I are not purists, and I don't see anything wrong with that. It's just that they're not very interesting to us.
Yeah, I'm a little bit glad that some of the regional trends are leaving. I mean, if I see one more plate of blackened redfish or blackened something or other anywhere in America other than New Orleans, I think I'm going to run screaming out of the restaurant. But I think, you know, certainly if you live in one city, you don't always want to eat ribs if you live in Memphis. I'm sure you would get a craving for something else every now and then. But when we're on the road, we really do focus about restaurants in their own regions.
I know you recently redesigned your kitchen. Since food is a profession as well as a pleasure for you, how did you design your kitchen? What does it look like?
Well,
what were the principles you took into account before figuring out what kind of kitchen you wanted?
The principle that we would stop elbowing each other out of the way and screaming at each other every time we tried to cook, because Michael and I, it really was like making war instead of making love in the kitchen when we would cook as a couple, because we were always like stepping on each other's feet and elbowing each other and reaching over the other person who had the big butcher knife to get to the sink. So we really wanted, even though we spend all of our time together and travel everywhere together, in the kitchen we declared separate camps. And so there's the Jane part of the kitchen that has my little cooktop and sink and burner, and then there's Michael's part of the kitchen, and the Twains or the Sterns do not meet while we cook.
You see, the two of us have completely different styles of cooking. Jane is the type of cook who, as she cooks, you know, will dirty like 18 different dishes and just throw them all into the sink and clean them up sometime later. I, on the other hand, am very methodical and compulsive about it. And every time I use a dish or a measuring cup, I clean it right away. Two people who cook like that cannot cook together. And since Jane and I have to spend so much time in the kitchen testing the recipes that we get from all of these restaurants, we decided it would be better if we just had adjoining areas rather than having to share anything.
The only thing missing is a big screen or curtain that goes down the middle of the kitchen so we don't even have to see each other's mess.
I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Jane and Michael Stern's new book, A Taste of America, is published by Andrews McMeel. Their weekly column, A Taste of America, is carried by close to 200 newspapers. This is Fresh Air.